Music is so much a part of everyone's lives. I mean, some of us have sometimes talked about trying to advocate for a day where there is literally no music. What would the radio stations do? What would happen to the TV shows? Because they all depend on music in the background. And that's all proper composers writing that stuff. You know, somebody has to learn how to do this. A day without music would be quite a disruptive day.
Welcome to Herstory, an RTRFM podcast series exploring the lives, careers and successes of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we hear stories from some of the trailblazing women who've left their mark on the world. At this point in the series, we've spoken to women from all different walks of life. A refugee who's connecting families with their loved lost ones, a pioneer in the domestic violence advocacy space, and a Newland farmer. Today, we're invited into the world of Margaret Sears. When I first saw Margaret on the list of inductees, the only information given was her specialty in keyboard music of the 18th century, which of itself is interesting and could be an entire episode. But what I soon discovered was her very own special ties to RTRFM here in Perth. I asked Margaret to recall her time at RTRFM from its beginning in 1977. It turns out Margaret remembers it differently, starting in 1976, a whole year prior to the station being ushered into existence. And that's for a very good reason. Margaret remembers it as 1976 because she was behind the scenes, setting up shop as the station's very first music director. Margaret has lived such a fascinating life, with stints at the head of the Australia Council and at the University of Western Australia. This is her story. Margaret, we'll start back at the beginning. I think that's just the logical place to start things. Born in Surrey in England, your parents were working there after the Second World War. Do you have any memories of those early childhood times?
No, I don't, because I came, or they brought me out here, I should say, when I was at 18 months. I have photos of me sitting in a pram in the snow. People seem to think it would build up resilience of children if they left them out in the snow.
Were you wearing, like, a
coat? Oh, yes. I was very well rugged up. And I do attribute the fact that I've moved down south and I hate the heat. I find the heat in Perth very difficult these days. I attribute that to my early days out in the snow.
You might have only been in the UK for, 18 months, but yeah. I think that was enough for
yes.
you to... What was the impetus for your family to move to Australia?
Oh, well, they were from Perth, so my father was sent over to London to work just after the war, and then he was asked to come back in about 1950-51.
Okay. Essentially, you've been raised here?
Well, my parents were Australian citizens. I was strangely caught up in this change of all the citizenship rules, which seemed to happen around the 1970s, which I hadn't really been aware of till I went to get a passport renewal, and I was told I wasn't eligible.
Oh, you're an alien.
I was an alien. I had to get Australian citizenship, which I was most offended about.
Did you know that you weren't technically an Australian
citizen? No, not at all. No, you know, Mum and Dad just took me off the boat and
off you
I don't think there was anything different, you know.
Does that make you a £10 pom then?
Probably not, because no one gave me £10.
Oh, well, there we go. The childhood that you spent here in Australia then, do you have any memories of role models during that time or people that you really admired maybe on TV or on the radio or within your own family?
Well, interestingly, of course, we didn't get television in my home till I was 12. I'm of that age where I can still remember going into the city, and we all used to walk along because the electronic stores would have a television in their front window showing whatever, often just ads. And we used to just go and look at those things amazingly. So, you know, there wasn't a role model as such from the media. No, I think, you know, I had some good teachers at school that probably had an impact. I think my family probably had an impact, yeah, but role models, not necessarily.
We've been doing a lot of research about all the inductees that we're speaking to, and one of the pieces of information that came up that I found most interesting that I'm really excited to discuss is your time at school, at St Hilda's Anglican School. You were the school pianist.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you become tasked with such an important job at, I imagine, such a young age?
Well, they had a system of prefects, and before I was in the final year, because I had been learning the piano for a number of years, and they just asked me, we used to sing hymns, can you believe? I used to play the hymns, and then they wanted to have a march in and a march out, all very old-fashioned. And so they used to ask me to play those, and it just became my normal. I was asked to do that every morning, so I did.
I went to Catholic school, so I get it. They're still doing those things.
Oh, really?
Without fail.
Yes.
When did you start learning the piano?
Oh, I think I was probably about 7 or 8, something like that, quite young.
Was it something that was always encouraged in your home? Did your parents play music?
They didn't, but my grandfather played the piano, and Mum loved classical music. I can remember being taken to concerts with what I now realise were quite eminent international pianists, when I was very young, in Perth in what used to be called the Capitol Theatre, which is no longer. And we had, classical records, old LPs and so forth. And my grandfather, as I say, used to play. One of my earliest memories about classical music actually having an impact on me is I was staying with my grandparents who lived in Rolleystone. Mum, Dad and we all lived in Mozzie Park. And they took me up there for, a weekend away. And I was in bed at night. My grandfather was playing Slavonic Dances by Dvorak. And they were very quite soulful works. And they made me cry so much that Mum and Dad had to drive all the way from Mosman Park to Rolleystone to pick me up.
Oh, my goodness.
So I think that was my earliest contact with classical music as something that moved me.
You obviously grew up listening to that through live performances, which I think that if you spoke to classical music fans these days, they would be so jealous of some of the people that you got to see. Do you have any, names or memories of specific pianists?
Well, one was Claudio Arrau, who is a well-known, very well-known international pianist. We had a number of sort of top singers. I don't recall hearing Sutherland, but she was certainly on the radio. And these people were very sort of alive. You knew of them and you knew they were around.
Mm. Classical music has obviously informed a large part of your career, which we'll talk about shortly. But it's lovely to know that that was very much fostered in your home life as much as it was in school and tutoring. So the school pianist, you play the hymns, you do the ins and the outs. Where does that lead you after high school? Was it always apparent the decision to go to university for you?
Absolutely not. No one in my family had been to university. Dad had left school at 15 and so on, which was very common, not uncommon for people his age. And Mum was in that family of five, four of whom were girls. None of them were encouraged to go to university. The only one who went was her brother. I know we were all given a form to fill in. I was very vague about all of this. I didn't even think about going to university. We got a form filled in our last year at school, and I must have filled it in and taken it home for Mum and Dad to sign, or maybe not, I don't know. At that time, we still got scholarships to go to university. So it wasn't the free education you had from Gough Whitlam on, but effectively you got a scholarship and you had to do pretty badly to lose that scholarship. So I got a scholarship to go to UWA, so I just sort of rocked up. And then choosing what units I'd do, well, I thought I'd do music because I did enjoy music, and I thought I'd do history because I did well in history and what was the leaving, which is the old-fashioned matriculation. And French I did because I enjoyed French, and political science because I was interested in politics. All of those things have stood me in good stead, actually, in later life.
What was the reaction like when you decided I wanted to do music and history and French? Because I can't imagine they were popular in terms of what was going to be helpful in later life during that time.
Well, back then nobody seemed to worry about a career. Everyone sort of knew that you'd get a job when you finished uni, and there was no rush to get through. People were taking 10 years over a degree because they were having such a good time, and it was a very different sort of mindset around the student body than the recent decades at university. I don't recall anyone saying to me, well, you're going to have trouble getting a job through the arts. And this is one of the things I get extremely annoyed about with the current federal government's approach to funding of arts and humanities at universities. I know a lot of people who are graduates from those departments who've done extremely well in non-arts related fields later in life.
All the skills have been like transferable.
Yeah, that's right. And research skills, analysis skills and so on.
It's so interesting to hear that you weren't necessarily encouraged but not discouraged from pursuing those passions either.
I honestly don't think my parents really knew what it was about. It was such a strange, not an alien world, I don't mean that, but it was just an unknown world to them. The fact that I went off to Crawley every morning and often didn't get home till quite late at night. You know, night lectures were very common then, and we used to eat in the ref, abominable food and so on. It was just, you know, we sort of lived at university and we had a great time.
So besides the terrible food, and it sounds like a lot of socialising.
Oh, yes, it was. I joined the undergraduate choir, so that was a very, very social group. We had great times and great parties and so on.
I love that. What about studying music at UWA? What was the curriculum or the course content like then?
Well, it was very traditional in those days. We had sort of technical subjects like harmony and oral training and musical analysis, and, you know, we're having to learn to write music in the style of Bach or one of the very early composers called Palestrina. And we had music history, and then we got involved in my case because I played the piano and I didn't play an instrument. I didn't get involved in an orchestra, so I was involved with the choir and did a lot of the accompanying, you know, on the piano for the choir.
In sort of a sidestep from music and from study, there were a couple of other things going on in your life at the time. You played netball,
yes.
Which you knocked the first, and I don't think you're going to be the last person we speak to in this series that's played netball.
There was a limited palette of things women played then.
What was your position, Margaret?
I was usually a wing attack.
Me too! We're off the same bird of a feather. I love that. But also, spending some time at the family farm, what kind of farm are we talking?
It was up near the Chittering Valley. It was a sheep farm, which my brother ran. We used to go up there a lot and sort of help work there, you know, sort of stacking timber for burning or, you know, rounding up sheep or whatever. I did that for many years when I first had children. You know, we used to take them up there as well.
That's so lovely that it's a strong family memory.
Yes, that's right.
In 1970, you completed your master's degree. Mm-hmm. Was the process of that different from what you'd previously been doing studying at UWA?
Yes, because it was quite a solitary experience, you know, really basically doing research and writing up the research. We didn't do a lot of seminars or presentations that you would tend to do today, whereas previously, you know, I can remember doing things like the music school in those days was over where the Festival of Perth office is now, which is an old house that's been converted. And we had a music library in the old annex. And I can remember at night, a bunch of us decided we'd listen to the whole of Wagner's Ring Cycle, which you might know is about 16 hours, depending on how fast a composer takes it, for big operas around 4 hours each. And what we would do, we'd go down to what we call Greasy's Hamburger Bar, which is down in Hampton Road, and we'd get ourselves a hamburger, and then we'd sit in the music library, and, you know, the night watchman would come, and we'd tell him we hadn't finished yet, and he'd sort of have to come back about midnight, and we'd all sort of clear off, you know. But we'd have a great time, you know, sort of, it was a very social event as well. So suddenly changing to a master's where you're pretty much, it's you in the library with the musical scores and at home, it was quite different.
I can imagine as well that's not necessarily something that you had always intended to do. I mean, you weren't even sure if university was going to be go for you.
No, I certainly, and in fact, I don't think I really enjoyed doing the master's. I did a PhD later. I think I got research then. I'm not sure that I did when I did the master's degree. I think it was a bit of a chore for me.
UWA must have been like a second home for you for many, many years. Mm. You were studying there, your master's is from there. And another part of UWA, which I'm so excited to talk about, it shares a really special place in the hearts of RTRFM staff and listeners and lovers. You were there at the very first incarnation of what this radio station is, but back then it had a bit of a different name. It was 6 UWA, then 6 UBS. Mm. Tell us about your time, because it actually predates the very first broadcast of that.
a couple of us were appointed. I was appointed as a music producer, but my task was to basically pull together a range of, you know, a year's worth, really, of music programs. The station itself didn't have much material, so we had to use the music library, University Music Library, and we're talking LPs, we're pre-CDs and cassettes then. So really it was my job to devise programs, programs that I thought would work well together, to look at other recordings and material that we might be able to get from other sources for the station. So, you know, we would contact Deutsche Welle in Germany. They used to put out great stuff. And a lot of the overseas countries, as part of their cultural diplomacy, you could buy recordings or get free recordings through their consulates and so on. So that was really my role. We had a director whose job was to devise how the whole day's program might look and sound, you know, with news and everything else. Yes, it was a complete unknown for me. So really I just had to find out what a music producer might do in, say, the ABC or somewhere like that, and try and follow suit as best I could.
You were RTRFM's first music director.
That's right. Yes, complete novice yet again.
Was radio something you'd been interested in before?
Not particularly, no. I was just asked if I'd like to do it. I had come back from England and I was doing some study leaves. In those days, you had study leave replacements. In other words, an academic could go off on their sabbatical and they would hire someone to do their work. And I had done that for 2 years, and then this job came up for the third year, so I said, oh, yes, I'll do it.
So that starts in 1976. Of course, the first broadcasters then switched on in 1977, and almost 45 years later,
here we are.
This interview is being recorded in the RTRFM studio. It's your first time here.
Yes.
What do you think?
Oh, well, very, very different. Very different. I mean, the whole building, you know, we had an old, I don't know what the, I think these buildings might have even been used during the war for some reason. They were almost like prefabs at UWA. You know, no air conditioning, nothing like that, you know, sort of very old.
I suspect there wasn't as much red on the walls back there either.
No, not. And the equipment was still being purchased and so on,
It's so lovely to speak to you on a personal note because of the RTRFM connection, but also obviously your work extends far beyond the radio side of things. You were already at this point teaching. Tell me about how that link happened for you from studying into then teaching.
I was in England, actually teaching in a school which was probably the worst experience of my life because I was not a trained teacher and it was a very rough school. The headmaster had this bizarre idea that to teach these kids who were, a lot of them, real problem children, you know, for various reasons, not necessarily of their own, and wanted me to teach them to love the music of Bach. Well, you know, a lot of sort of well-established adults find the music of Bach complex, so, you know, it was a very difficult task. I didn't enjoy that, and then I got a letter out of the blue. No, I got a telegram from the head of the music department at UWA, Sir Frank Calloway, asking me if I'd like to come back and do one of these fill-ins for study leave to teach basically the first years and the second years. So I did, and then another staff member went on study leave the next year, so I did it for another year. Basically after that, I mean, I had a couple of kids, but I kept part-time teaching a number of years until the mid-1980s.
And you became head of the School of Music at UWA at 1.2.
Yes, in the early 90s, yes.
How did it feel sort of going from a student of the School of Music to then becoming the head of the department?
Well, it was a strange system back then. Any academic could be asked to be head of department. I'm trying to think, at one point it used to be voted on by the staff. I don't know if this, I can't remember.
That feels problematic.
Yes, but there was no training or, you know, you had to do everything. You didn't have finance officers or anything as they will do today, and you know, faculty finance officers and so on. You had to work out all the budgets and things like building in superannuation didn't even on my radar till I hit that sort of situation. So it was, and then dealing with, you know, not so much personnel issues, but certainly, you know, problem student issues. It's a real eye opener.
So obviously some of the administrative tasks are quite different and, like you said, a bit of a baptism of fire, maybe.
That's right.
What about the actual school itself? I mean, the curriculum, the way things were taught. Did that feel like that was a big change as well? Did you notice a change from when you were a student?
It was very much academic driven, you know, so particular academics were specialists in particular areas. We weren't actually as extreme in that in the School of Music as in some other schools. So in my time, I had to teach everything from medieval music through to music of the mid-20th century. And I could no way claim I'm a specialist in all of those. But because we had such a huge range of things we had to teach, we had to be fairly versatile. So to that extent, it was similar to when I went through some of the stuff like writing music in the style of Bach, that had disappeared. That had come to us with an academic who came out of Oxbridge somewhere. And that was the way he'd been taught when he was a student in England, you know, about 50 years earlier. So that had certainly gone.
Was that what you were quite fond of, though? Obviously, classical music is your MO, right?
Oh, yes. I was more fond of things like analysis of the music. I always found that really interesting to see how composers put the music together. I wasn't that keen on writing in the style of Bach. I'd rather study how Bach wrote it himself.
When you have to teach these other styles that you are not necessarily an absolute expert in, though, did you have a favourite? Was there a medieval, I don't know, harp you're quite fond of?
I think it was more, there were works in the 16th century that I really loved, partly because it was very interesting to me how the music, while it lagged well behind other arts, particularly the visual arts, you could, in a sense, see some works of music and some composers reflecting particular artists. And I'm thinking of people like Raphael and Michelangelo and so on. And you could almost find musicians that had the same approach to their art, and I've always found that really interesting. So in Renaissance music, I found that quite interesting because I was always interested in the art.
Well, and always interested in history as well. I mean, studied that as part of your undergrad.
Yeah, but I've always been interested in history, yeah.
It's one of the beautiful things about music is it is such a good time stamp of times and periods within history. Not necessarily the correct timestamp, as they are lagging, but still pretty great to see what's representative.
Yeah,
I want to talk more about the modern era of music shortly, but we have to speak about a career change for you in 1995. Great year, by the way. That's when I was born.
Oh, well, there you go.
You were asked to apply for a job for the Director of Arts WA. Can you tell us a bit about what the state of arts in Western Australia or across the country as a whole was at that moment?
In Western Australia, the department was, I think it was about 10 years old then, but it was a government department. Now it's merged in with local government sport and, you know, the casino, she says quietly. Basically, my job was to oversee the department and then to coordinate the rest of the arts portfolio, which is the museum, the library, the art gallery and Screen West. And within the department, we did a lot of things like we did arts policy, but we also did the grants that go out to the arts. Nationally, the difference between what we did and, say, what they did federally, I became involved in that subsequently, is federally, at that time, all of the money really used to go out of the Australia Council, the arts funding, and the policy advice was very strong from the Australia Council to the ministers. These days, it's a little bit different. The minister himself has sequestered quite a bit of the funding that goes directly out of the ministry.
And what about what was happening in, say, the music space in the 90s? Can you remember, was it a big focus on international acts coming and touring Australia, or were we seeing more people out in local industries getting amongst it?
Yeah, there'd been quite a push almost since the time of Gough Whitlam to have more homegrown Australian music supported. By the 90s, we had a number of composers, well-known names like Peter Sculthorpe or Ross Edwards, Richard Mills, whose music was regularly being performed, as well as, you know, sort of international names and international musicians coming to Australia. But one of the interesting things in those early years of the 1990s, particularly over in Sydney, quite something you might call the culture wars going on in music between the people who supported modernism, which was a very purist, almost esoteric approach to writing, and those who supported an approach to music you might describe as being more readily acceptable to the average audience's ears. And there was a lot of battle going on both in press and politically around that, particularly in the eastern states.
And that's the time that you decided to transition from educator to arts administrator.
That's right. Yes.
What was it like, that move? I mean, you were nervous to make the move into education. Now you're leaving that world and heading into arts admin. What was that transition like?
Well, I was nervous because I'd never been a bureaucrat, so having to go and become a bureaucrat was something new for me. I think it was my second day in the job in the State Department. I had to rock up to parliamentary estimates, which is actually happening right now, where heads of department and sections have to go to parliament and be confronted by questions from various members, usually the opposition. And I had to do that on day two. So that was a real baptism of fire. You sit with your minister and so on. But all of those things, writing government policies, getting approvals, liaising with the minister's office, all of that, of course, was completely new to me. And then when I went, and after a couple of years, I was actually asked to go and chair the Australia Council, which is based in Sydney but delivers nationally, the federal government's arts funding and advisory body. And one of the first things the minister said to me is, I want you to go and talk to all this group called the Australia Council Reform Society. It was a group of people who hated the Australia Council and wanted to see it abolished, and for me to go and find out what their problem was and try and resolve it. So,
that was another
baptism of fire.
It's important to note here, you were, like you said, the chair of the Australia Council, which is the official arts funding and advisory body for the federal government. Mm. At least in theory, that's how it works. Yes. Mm-hmm. You're also the first Western Australian to chair the Australia Council. That's a huge achievement.
Yes, well, in one sense, yes, Taylor. I think there was some politics behind it. I think there was a lot of angst around, as I say, through these culture wars. And there was a lot of angst on the East Coast about who was getting funded by the Australia Council and who wasn't. When many of the art forms, particularly in music, literature, and not so much the visual arts, but dance. And it did tend to emanate out of New South Wales primarily, but not exclusively. And I think the Australia Council was a bit on the nose with the government of the day. It was John Howard's government just came in, and they heard all this stuff going on. And I think one of the complaints that was relevant for Western Australia was that the Australia Council was too Sydney-centric. So that so much of everything, policy, funding, everything was going to Sydney. So my understanding is that John Howard wanted to find someone from as far away from Sydney as possible to become the chair of the Australia Council. And he happened to ask someone who I had worked with over there, a close colleague or friend of his, actually. And he must have mentioned my name. And so that's how it came about. I was about as far away as you could get unless you went to Rottnest.
Well, I mean, look, it worked out for the best. You did some amazing things there. It sounds like there's been a lot of people who have helped and supported you through your career and through the changes in industry. But what about some of the challenges that you face, Margaret? I mean, these industries, even still to this day at the highest levels, are predominantly run by men. Mm. Was that something that you ever had to come up against?
I certainly did at university. As I say, I was working part-time for most of the 80s, but when I became a full-time staff member, there was no female toilet in the School of Music, so I was expected to, share the loos with the women. And on one sense, that's not a problem. You do that these days, you go there.
But gender-neutral bathrooms, yes, now as well.
Well, exactly. But I just thought, that they had seen fit to give the male staff, their own loo. What about female staff? Because there were plenty of part-time females, coming in teaching flute or whatever. So I kicked up a fuss about that, got that. That was one thing. But more fundamentally. So I didn't get onto the superannuation, you know, chain until, you know, later than most people because, you know, I had been part-time all that time.
So even in part-time work...
Your superannuation allocation was not the same. I got to a certain level and I think I was teaching quite a significant range of classes and I applied for promotion to senior lecturer, I think, from lecturer, and it was rejected on the basis that I hadn't completed my PhD. I was still completing my PhD. So I was in the Faculty of Arts, like everyone else. So I looked at across the faculty and there were a lot of men who were either senior lecturers, associate professors or professors who did not have a PhD. I counted them up, at least 20, I remember. So I went to see the Deputy Vice Chancellor of the day, never thinking that one day I'd be in his role and have to deal with similar things. But I went to see him and said, this is discrimination because, you know, you're telling me you won't promote me until I have a PhD. Well, what about all these people? Anyway, I was near the end of it and they agreed that as soon as it was submitted, I'd be promoted. So they had to stick by their rules, but they sort of waived them in my case.
That seems bizarre, incredibly, incredibly discriminatory. Mm. You were in the process of completing your PhD at the time of applying. Were these other people who were already in those senior positions, were they also in the midst of completing a PhD?
Not all of them. Some of them had never done a PhD.
Mm. So what makes them more equipped to have those higher up roles than what you did as someone who was completing it?
Well, they've been there for quite a long time and there are certain degrees, and I won't sort of necessarily name them, but there are certain degrees where the traditions coming out of England were that you didn't need a PhD.
Sure.
So they became professors without it.
Mm. Do you think that's maybe one of the reasons or one of the barriers that stops women in pursuing roles in higher education?
It might have done then. I don't think so now. I actually think my observation over time was that it was a lot easier. I mean, when I was in the executive at UWA, we had 3 women, 3 men, so there was no ostensible problem there. If you asked me, you know, why I didn't sort of decide to stay on and put my hand up to become, you know, a vice-chancellor, I'd looked at the job. I'd done the deputy's job. I thought, I don't really want to do this. I don't need to do it, you know. There are other things, I need to do more.
Let's go back to the Australia Council just quickly. You come in and you are tasked with all of this policy work that you'd already started in the Western Australian sector. Federally, though, can you reflect on some of the changes that were able to be implemented while you were there?
Yeah. In a way, in that system as it was then, we had greater freedom at the Australia Council because it was our job to do a lot of stuff without, you know, having to take everything to the minister. I think that might have changed today too. But legislatively, you know, for example, if the minister wanted to tell us what to do, or if he, for example, chose to overturn a grant or to give a grant where we said no, he would have to table that in the parliament and it would have to sit for, I think it was 28 days. And of course, you know, no minister wants to have that, you know, with the media circus around them and so on. So it was pretty hands-off attitude. I had a very good minister, Richard Alston, much disliked by the ABC because they had an ongoing battle, but he was a very good minister for the arts. And one of the big things we did achieve was to try and stabilise some of the big companies. Well, for example, the WA Symphony Orchestra employs over 100 people. To try and stabilise those companies and keep people employed, we managed to get an extra $43 million for the arts, which at that time was quite a lot of money, that would go to that group and stabilise them. Whereas today, unfortunately, what seems to happen is if you shift the money over to one point, the people in the other point lose it. But then there was no one lost any money there. It was just, it was an additional one. And the minister was very supportive of that and got us the money because he was a senior cabinet member. We also got the Australia Council back involved in arts education, and that continues to be a really important but neglected area in Australia. We were involved in the first moral rights legislation, particularly for architects and designers. What was then called the Indigenous Mark of Authenticity. We used to call it Mark of Authenticity. So we developed this up so that people selling Indigenous products, and it was triggered by a quite famous case about use of an Indigenous carpet and carpet design by people without taking permission from the Indigenous, artists. We established that system so that people couldn't go around fleecing Aboriginal artists, basically.
It's crazy to me that it took till, you were at the Australia Council for that to even be a thing.
Well, again, I pay tribute to Senator Alston because he himself was a passionate supporter of Aboriginal artists and he had a lot of Aboriginal art himself. This is where, he would suggest to us and we would think, well, that's something that we really ought to be doing, and we would sort of develop that up, with his input and involvement, so we knew it would have support from government.
How do you feel about the Australia Council and the state of the Federal Arts and Culture Department today?
Well, I've never wanted to go out and talk much about the Australia Council, but I would say back in those days, I used to do a lot of speeches all around the country advocating for the arts and not beating the drum on behalf of the government of the day, but talking up the arts. And I did one National Press Club, and I remember it was called the arts, and I used the term benign neglect. That referred to both parties. I wasn't just because, there was one in power, you don't sort of start just being cravenly supportive of them. I feel the council could probably be a bit stronger on the advocacy front, but then, governments don't want that these days. I was very concerned. I was on the radio last week, so it's no secret that I'm very concerned about the process of some recent arts grants. Seems that the old idea that you look at people's track record and you get peers and others to make input about their quality, you do all of that before you give anyone a grant. It seems that's gone out of the window, not necessarily with the Australia Council, but in the Minister's department or office, I'm not sure where.
Tell me a little bit, Margaret, about your role and your passion and advocacy in music education in schools. It's changing pace a little bit, but I want to speak about that because you have been a pretty outspoken advocate about the state of music education at school.
Yes, well, I chaired a review into music education in Australia in 2005, and basically no one in the arts disputes or would argue for a moment that it's not something that's really important, and there's a whole lot of research. The thing I find most irritating about this whole debate about arts in schools, it's a bit like, for some people, climate change. People choose to ignore the research. And there's a raft of research about the benefits of arts education in schools on a range of factors. If I just use an anecdote, one that I still remember is a program that was introduced as a pilot in the Northern Territory, where in some schools in remote communities, the kids were given musical instruments and trained up as bands. And a whole lot of things emerged out of that, including complete change in terms of truancy. So the data went from about 90% of truancy to sort of 10 or something. Self-confidence of those children and them really wanting to be at school. Ability to communicate with each other, because in a band you've got to have minimum of however many people to speak with. All of that sort of stuff you can find over and over again, and it's particularly relevant for children who don't necessarily respond to the traditional way of teaching in schools that we've inherited from 19th century England, So I do find it extraordinary that we're still having this battle. The battle is not so much in the arts, as I've said. It's more in the education departments around the country, and they did have a chance when the whole push on STEM came up a few years ago, science, technology, engineering, maths. There was a chance to make it STEAM, so have arts in the middle of it, and unfortunately the then Directors General knocked that out.
Why is there such a hesitancy or a resistance to making arts and fully embracing it in curriculum?
Well, I think for some people it's not something that's relevant to them. And I would hasten to add that the current Director General in West Australia is not one of those people. So, you know, I'm not speaking out about the current sort of model. But one of the things is relevance. One of them is the crowded timetable. Every time something new gets put into the curriculum, something has to give. And, you know, no one's going to let maths go and no one's going to let, you know, social sciences go or whatever. So, oh, well, we'll be let the arts go. And then from the point of view of how you teach arts, when the national curriculum sort of set up and they looked at, you know, a typical way it was translated into schools, well, you'll have a term of music and a term of theatre and a term of visual art and so on. You certainly can't learn music like that. It just doesn't work. So there's the crowded curriculum, there's the attitudinal problem, and then there's the big one, which is the lack of trained teachers. Some of that comes back to the university system, but also the communication between universities and education departments.
Margaret, was there a point in your life, maybe when you were studying or in your first teaching jobs, that you realised that your entire being or your entire purpose was to really advocate for music and specifically for music getting the fair go that it needs?
No, not really. I just get irritated by on certain things where I feel people are almost deliberately turning blind eyes to things that are obvious and important.
For you and I, it's really easy to understand the value in arts and culture and specifically in music. For people out there who maybe are a little on the fence or they have maybe unfortunately turned a blind eye to it, can you tell us about the impact that music and culture has on our society?
Well, I think it became very clear during COVID. You know, the number of people who communicated through performances out of their living rooms and who set up bands across the country on, you know, through Zoom and so forth. We're talking about a range of types of music too. We're not necessarily just talking classical music here. But music is so much a part of everyone's lives. I mean, some of us have sometimes talked about trying to advocate for a day where there is literally no music. You can imagine what would the radio stations do? What would happen to the TV shows? Because they all depend on music in the background. And that's all proper composers writing that stuff. It's not, you know, somebody has to learn how to do this. We all depend on it. You go into the supermarket, they've done a lot of research to make sure the right sort of music is playing that's conducive to buying.
What would we do without Coles Radio?
Well, yeah, and you sort of just keep on going and going and going. And a day without music would actually be quite a disruptive day, because there'd be a lot of things, particularly but not exclusively radio stations and premises and so on, which would have quite a lot of trouble.
When I was first looking through the list of people who we would be speaking to for the Herstory podcast series, your name came up, and the only piece of information that I was given was of your love and interest in specifically keyboard music of the 18th century. That's all I was given. I didn't have any of these amazing notes and pieces of research and all of your awards and commendations. I want to talk about that. Can you tell me where this specialisation in 18th century keyboard music comes from?
If I had to say, especially when I was an academic, what my favourite era of music was, and still, I love the music of the Baroque, and I particularly love the music of Bach and Handel. But in the 1980s, I sort of thought to myself, look, I decided to go back to playing the piano, which I let go for a while. And I thought, I'm never going to be able to climb over these massive Chopin preludes or Schumann fantasy or, you know, any of the big stuff anymore. I just, you know, I haven't got the time to do it for a start, but I haven't probably got the ability. And then I thought, well, the thing I really love, I also love playing the music of Bach and Handel and Scarlatti, composers like that, and harpsichord is the sort of conducive instrument there. So I took myself off to England to have some lessons in harpsichord as opposed to piano, which is quite a different technique because it's quite a different instrument, and that's where that came from.
I love that. I don't know many other people who have a specialisation that specific. Does anybody else in your life share that love with you?
No, probably not. No, I think for some people, Bach is acquired taste isn't the right term, but it can be hard to understand how to listen to it if you haven't actually sort of been trained in that way.
Have your own children taken an interest in music like you have?
No. I mean, look, both of them enjoy, you know, will come particularly to a symphony orchestra if I'll take them, but they're not musicians, no.
Have you got grandchildren that you can start to mould now?
Oh, well, they're starting to play the piano. Thank God it's the piano, not the violin.
Do you teach them?
No. Oh, no. I'd be a terrible teacher.
Are your teaching days over, Margaret?
Oh, absolutely. Mm.
What are you doing with yourself now? Are you still sitting on boards of different organisations?
Yes. Yeah, I'm on the board of Music Aviva, which is a national music organisation, here in WA on the board of Lost and Found Opera. And down south where I live, I'm on the Southern Forest Arts Board, which is particularly focused on bringing arts to that region. But I chair the Salaries and Allowances Tribunal of West Australia, so that's about something very different. You know, we set the salaries for the politicians and the senior public servants and
well, you've worked in that world as well, haven't you?
Yeah, so I'm sort of involved with that, and I'm actually doing a few other jobs within government. I was very involved that we had the McGowan government commissioned a review of the public service back in 2017-18, so I was one of a three-person panel that did that, which was very interesting. So I've kept working in that area to some extent.
One of the roles that you've had that we haven't had a chance to talk about, and I do want to touch on it, is the Perth International Arts Festival, now known as the Perth Festival. When did you come to that role?
Well, when I was the Deputy Vice-Chancellor, the Senior Deputy Vice-Chancellor at UWA, the festival used to report in to me because they're very much a part of the university then. The slight change now. Anyway, so I had the line management of the festival, so I used to sit on the board for that reason. Then when I retired, the previous chair asked if I'd like to take over from him as chair of the festival. So I did that for 3 years and yeah, great. I really enjoyed doing that.
What year was that in?
I think I finished in 2015, so probably 2012, I think.
Okay.
Something like that.
It's such a fantastic event on the Western Australian calendar.
Yeah.
It's kind of the things that you all love, right? It's the amalgamation of arts and music, film, bit of history, some dance in there. All the things you've occupied yourself
with. Yes, that's right.
On top of this incredible career through so many different industries, you've also been awarded with a huge swag of achievements. You've co-authored 2 published books. Mm-hmm. You also have been inducted into the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame, which is where this podcast comes in. Something that I've been asking all of the people that we speak to is about this concept or the term herstory, which is the name of this podcast. Mm. Is that something you've heard before?
I've heard the term, yes.
Do you have any thoughts about the word herstory?
Well, I think a thought about it, which is probably more than just about women. I was listening yesterday to an interesting interview about Anita Heiss, a novelist who's written a novel set in colonial Australia, but from an indigenous sort of indigenous voice and so forth. I think as this project that you're embarking on and others will evolve, we will hear more and more about some of the curious and extraordinary and weird things that were the case for all of us in the 70s and 80s and 90s or early 90s, you know, such as the no female toilet thing that I mentioned, or, you know, not getting promoted when a whole lot of blokes were. And I think everyone, male and female, will look back at one stage and say, what on earth was all that about?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're going to uncover, I think, a lot of those stories, but also some really lovely stories that we wouldn't hear from anybody else, like being the first music director of 6UWA. That was a woman. That was you.
Yeah.
Nobody else can take that story. That's quite
true.
Literally your herstory. Tell me about what it was like to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. You were inducted in 2016. Do you remember receiving the message that was going to happen?
Yes, I do. Yeah, well, it was because because there were some, you know, some of the women I had read about who had been inducted were, you know, sort of people I really admired. So, no, it was a great thing to do, I think. Yeah.
You were also awarded the Officer of the Order of Australia, which is a huge achievement. Congratulations. What was that like?
That was great. Yes, turning up to the ceremony in Government House was a very nice sort of event, you know, to took along the family.
I'm sure they were very excited to be there.
Yes, they were all very,
you.
Very, very excited. Yes, no, that was a great thing. I was very pleased to receive that.
Well, there are lots of bathrooms at UWA now for everybody to access. You're in the Hall of Fame and you're still sitting on a bunch of boards and advisory panels. But you spend a lot of time outside of the city now. Mm. What are you doing day to day now, Margaret?
Well, we have a little farm, 50 acres down in the Southern Forest area, south of Manjimup. I have a lot of fruit trees and vegetable gardens and so forth to keep me busy. You know, I can spend time down there working. Of course, COVID has meant that, you know, I haven't been to Sydney for a board meeting of Music Aviva now for, you know, since the beginning of last year. So Zoom has become a great thing where we are. So it's, yes, very different life. It's a different climate.
Cooler, though.
Much cooler, especially through winter and even in summer. You know, there's only about two nights where we don't have a blanket in summer. So that suits me better. That's, you know, sort of just helping my husband Roger out on the farm doing stuff, you know.
Before we wrap up, Margaret, one last thing that I just want to get your thoughts on. You've already mentioned a little bit in our conversation today about not being discouraged from pursuing a career in music or in the arts. For people now, it can be a little bit different, this idea of future planning and going to university or getting qualifications that will ensure that you have a job that you'll be able to survive and, you know, provide for yourself. What do you have to say to people who are still with rose-coloured glasses looking at pursuing careers in music or arts?
Well, you know, I've never gotten over back in, I don't know, probably just after I retired. No, I was still at university in the Vice-Chancellery, and I was asked to speak to a Leadership WA group. So I gave a spiel and, you know, they were interested in what my job at the university was. And then one young man who turned out to be from one of the banks said, "So you're the deputy CEO of a more than $500 million a year business." He said, "How do you get to be that from doing a music degree?" And I said, "Well, probably because I did a music degree." And then I sort of went on to, you know, elaborate on that about, you know, what I particularly in reflection learned through studying music, but also political science, because, you know, obviously I'm quite involved in that world now, and history, and, you know, having to analyse and sort of discriminate and so on and so forth. I think that people should look around and see the number of people, if you like using the term high-flying people, who are not necessarily just graduates of business schools or, you know, engineering faculties. And there are a lot of them, not least on the East Coast as well.
Lots of our politicians have Bachelors of Arts.
Well, the governor was a contemporary of mine when I was at university, so there you go.
No way. There you
doing the arts degree.
Margaret, before we go, we are a radio station predominantly. We play lots of music. If you had to name an artist or a particular song or composition that you absolutely love, could you tell us what that would be?
My current favourite. I go through these phases where I like to follow up and learn a bit more about works that I didn't really cover very much, either as a student or as a lecturer. Is Sibelius's Violin Concerto. So there you go. Work from Finland, end of the 19th, beginning 20th century, stylistically. It's just something I love at the moment.
I'm looking so forward to finding that and playing it on the radio now. Margaret Sears, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you, Taylor.
Thanks to Margaret Sears and to all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to all the incredible women who make history happen. Our executive producer, Danae Gibson, assistant producers Courtney Withers, Fiona Bartholomaeus and Sophie Minisale. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses. and artwork by Peter Roebuck. Zoe Zarzicki also helped to edit this episode. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name is Taylor Strano. I'll catch you next week for episode 6.